Israel's Evangelical Connection, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Christian Zionists believe there's a direct connection between their personal salvation and America's support of Israel.
We will be blessed because we support Israel.
Also, Salvadorans deported from the U.S. back to a country they hardly know.
You know, I grew up in California, married and got old and, you know, did all my life up there. All of a sudden, I got deported and I find myself in a strange place.
Plus, he's the Kansas Jayhawks' secret weapon in the NCAA Men's Final Four this weekend.
I call him the baby Shaquille O'Neal. You know, he is in that paint. He always wants to go up strong, score buckets. Really, he has what it takes, you know, to dominate.
The story is coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Thanks for being with us today. It is Good Friday. It's also the Muslim Day of Prayer, and tonight Passover begins, a coincidence of celebrations of the world's three main monotheistic religions. We're going to kick things off today in Israel, where these three faiths live and try to exist side by side. We did say try. This is a sound of clashes today between Palestinians and Israeli troops. Charlie Sennett is in Jerusalem. He's the founder of the Ground Truth Project here at WGBH. It's joy and sorrow at once. That's Jerusalem in many respects, isn't it, Charlie?
Yeah, it is. You know, it's one of these days here where the three faiths really come together, and you can feel it on the streets. You see people rushing around getting ready for Passover on West Jerusalem and the Jewish side and in the Jewish quarter of the Old City. You know, the call to prayer today was sort of drizzling rain, and everyone was rushing to the Muslim call to prayer from the Palestinian side in East Jerusalem. And then, of course, it's Good Friday. So Palestinian Christians and really Christians from all over the world were gathering. But while they were doing that, there's this horrific news from Gaza.
I mean, Jerusalem has always been a politically charged city, more so this year with Donald Trump declaring his recognition of Jerusalem as the official capital of Israel. And let's talk about one group of people in particular that was pushing for that move, a group many of us haven't heard of. You've been looking at the Christian Zionist influence in Jerusalem. Who are the Christian Zionists and what role do they play on the ground there in Jerusalem and generally in Israel-Palestine?
Christian Zionists really are an interesting group. They're basically people who believe that the return of Jews to the Holy Land and the establishment of the State of Israel is in accordance with biblical prophecy. You know, I used to think of this as sort of a fringe movement. When I was here reporting a lot over the years, I'd say 10 years ago, it was gaining steam. 15, 20 years ago, it was totally fringe. Now it's mainstream. This is really a movement now. There are a lot of different organizations and agencies that are gathering money from the United States, from people who believe in Christian Zionism, who believe there is a prophecy. And it sounds fringe, and I'm sure many of your listeners are thinking that, but it's really getting traction, and it's raising a lot of money, and it had great influence on the decision by the Trump administration to move the embassy.
You've actually been spending some time with some of the Christian Zionists. Tell us about that and who you've met and what they're thinking.
Just to give you an example, I was walking through the streets of the Old City on the Via Dolorosa. So this is the path that tradition holds where Jesus would have carried the cross. Hmm. And I was just talking to people from all over the world, Christians from all over the world. And I just spotted one guy who was wearing a North Face jacket, Ray-Bans, and I just knew he was American. I went up to him. He was like the first guy I interviewed, literally, who was an American. And he was from Spencer, Massachusetts. He's a Pentecostalist. His name is Kevin Berner. And he really talked in some detail about the theology that he embraces around Christian Zionism, that it is essential for him to get to heaven to be a friend of Israel, and that the United States needs to be a friend of Israel. And he feels very strongly about that.
In the Obama administration, it was anti-Israel. And I correlate that to a lot of the falling down of America. And Trump is pro-Israel, and I believe that we will be blessed because we support Israel. I believe really strongly that we're in the end of times.
Wow, in the end of times, he says.
That phrase, Marco, in the end of times, is a haunting one if you know your theology. This is basically a sort of biblical apocalypse in which, you know, there is a reckoning that happens, and there is a decision that is made. Either you become part of the following of Jesus Christ or you don't, and you are killed, or you have to wait for the rapture to come again, and you wait in suffering. It is a theology that sounds bizarre, and for many mainstream Christians, it is bizarre. It is a very warped reading of the Bible, but for an increasing number of evangelical Christians, this is alive. This is resonant. What's stunning to me in looking at this more closely here on this reporting trip is just how much traction it's gotten, just how mainstream it's become. It's very divisive in the Christian churches. The mainstream Catholic and Protestant churches have often viewed this as very flawed theology. And there's also a division among many Jewish theologians about whether or not to accept this gift. Because remember, in this prophecy, if Jews don't convert to Christianity, then they are going to not be among the chosen to go to heaven. And this apocalyptic vision, Jews either convert or die. That is pretty upsetting to many people who are Jewish. It's something that the Jewish community is really grappling with, and there are many Jews who have decided that the Christian evangelical movement has tempered that message or somehow softened the theology, and they're willing to accept the funding. And among them is Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, very supportive of Christian Zionists, very supportive of the funding they're providing to Israel.
Charlie, I'm really curious, as Jews around the world sit down to celebrate Passover and ending the Seder, stating next year in Jerusalem, I mean, it's mostly been an aspirational and ritualistic statement, but what have you heard as you've been speaking with Jews there in Israel about the added political weight this year means to that Passover declaration?
Well, I think Jews will always want to come to Israel, and I think we'll see there will be many here next year in Jerusalem. I think the other thing I think a lot of people are thinking about here, and I really think this is on both sides, is what is the meaning of Passover and what is the meaning of Easter? And I've talked to religious leaders of all three different faiths on this trip who talk about the meaning of Passover is really about liberation, and it's about freedom, and it's about a people finding their land. And, you know, the Palestinians say, if you hold a mirror up, we're doing that too. And they want to say that to their Jewish friends who also live on this land, that they need a place too. And I think that that's resonant. I mean, that's what the violence in Gaza is about today. It's land day. It's really about a struggle for land. And they say we can't only look at the history of religion. We have to also look at how it reflects now. And I think the other holiday here, Easter, today's Good Friday, the day when tradition holds that Jesus was crucified. But when the resurrection is celebrated for Christians at Easter, it's a time of hope. And a lot of the Palestinians were looking for the message of hope in Easter. And I guess as someone who really loves the city, who lived here for years, I had two children born here, I really think that all three faiths have these messages of hope. And I think if we're going to talk about next year in Jerusalem, I'm going to try to hold on to the hope of this season that next year is better.
Charlie Sennett, founder of the Ground Truth Project based here at WGBH, speaking with us from Jerusalem. Always good to talk with you, Charlie. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
For many Christians, it's Holy Week, and that means family gatherings where certain foods are always on the table. For reporter Catherine Hernandez and her relatives in New York, it's a dish originally from the Dominican Republic. Here's her story.
My grandfather lives in Brooklyn, and during Holy Week, there's always a pot of lima beans, coconut milk, sugar, and cinnamon simmering on his stove. Habas con dulce, a traditional dish he's carried on since his mom's passing. Now, I'm eager to learn it from him. My grandfather's full name is Adriano Manen Campuzano. But we call him Papi, or Father, because he's the father of our entire family. We start making his habas con dulce by washing lima beans.
Bueno, cuando comience el vi, tú le bajas un poquito el fuego para que no se vaya a rebosar.
He says when the beans start to boil, lower the flame so they don't overcook. He also throws a few cinnamon sticks and cloves into the water. He says this dish reminds him of his parents and his childhood in Villa Altagracia, a mountainous town in the Dominican Republic. He remembers gathering the ingredients for the dessert there, picking lima beans and sugar cane, getting milk from the cows, going to the market for vanilla, cinnamon, cloves, and nutmeg. Now, he buys all of that at the supermarket. His memories of his mom, my great-grandmother, Eloisa Pozo, are also vivid. Her stern demeanor, her all-white Good Friday outfit, her hair wrapped in a scarf. But most of all, we remember her habas con dulce.
Loisa Pozo, ese era una barbaraza. Esa, cocinaba.
Mama Pozo was a serious cook, a force. And the family held on to this dish for generations, even when dictator Rafael Trujillo's reign in the 1930s forced them to move to another part of the country. And eventually, New York with hardly any savings.
La tradición de los ancestros de ellos, hacer habas con dulce. Entonces mi abuela llevó esa tradición.
That's my mom. She tells me how habas con dulce came from my family's town on the island and how it's now migrated with them. I wanted to learn more about the dish, though, and called Jose Guerrero, a food historian in the Dominican Republic.
Tú no vas a encontrar mucho eso en ninguna parte, ningún libro de historia, que era como alimento de pobres.
Guerrero says that today this dish is rarely made in the Dominican Republic, partly because it's associated with lower-income people. It's disappearing. Back at my grandfather's kitchen, the beans have been boiling for an hour. The apartment smells like the holidays. We drain the beans and add whole milk and evaporated milk into the pot. It all simmers for 5 hours until it's a thick paste. You eat it like pudding, and the little bits of beans melt in your mouth. Oh, and here's a tip. Get some crispy cassava bread. It's great for dunking. As my grandfather ladles out a serving of habas con dulce, steam hits my face. And everyone in the house rushes in to eat.
A comer habas con dulce!
In the Good Fridays to come, I tell my grandfather that I will be the safekeeper of this recipe. For the world, Catherine Hernandez, New York.
Catherine's story comes to us thanks to Feet in Two Worlds. Let me fill you in on some stories we'll have for you beginning next week. Globally, the number of women in prisons is going up. Across Latin America, for example, the number has nearly doubled in the past few decades. And studies say the spike in some places is at least partly related to illegal drugs. Next week, reporters for the world's Across Women's Lives desk take us to Mexico. Drug cartels there are at war with the Mexican government, and women are more and more often the victims. We've got this woman's story. Her name is Carmela. She falls in love with a drug dealer, and her new life is all about getting high on crack cocaine. One day, Carmela's drug dealer boyfriend tells her that if she wants more crack, she'll have to start selling drugs herself. Carmela's choice next week on The World. Also, the country with the largest number of women per capita behind bars, that's the U.S. And here, too, drug-related crimes are often the reason women serve time. In Ohio, it's opioid crimes.
I was taking pain medication for my foot, and that's where opiates escalated to. And then they become too expensive on the streets, so you start using heroin. It's cheaper, it's easier to get.
Why more and more women are behind bars, and whether prison gives them the best chance to get clean and turn their lives around. Some of the things we'll look at in four different countries, beginning next week. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We saw some poignant moments this week in Pakistan. Nobel Peace Prize winner Malala Yousafzai is back in her home country for the first time since being shot by Taliban militants almost 6 years ago. For security reasons, information about her movements and whereabouts is being kept mostly under wraps. But my BBC colleague Sikandar Kermani was able to meet with her for a few minutes, and he asked her how it feels to be home.
It is emotional. Each and everything I see, it is valuable to me. Even just this warm air, I value it and I'm enjoying it. And I am just so happy to be home and to put my feet on this land again. And I think this was the right time. The government also provided support. The Pakistan Army provided support and security.
Are you scared at all being here?
If I was scared, I would not have been here.
Whilst Malala is hugely admired across the world and in Pakistan, she also has a lot of critics here. I'm scrolling through people's comments on the BBC Urdu Facebook page, and there are lots and lots of people abusing her. Some, like this one, call her a CIA or Western agent. Others allege she faked the attack against her.
How does it feel when you read those kind of comments?
Firstly, I just don't understand, like, why do they oppose me and what is the reason behind it? I want a better future for this country. That's why I started speaking out for girls' education. That's why I did not fear anything. And I said, even if the terrorists attack me, it does not matter. I will continue speaking out. And it did happen, and I continued my campaign for girls' education. So my focus is only working for the good. It's 200 million people, and I know that 99%, more than 99% stand with me, support me. They believe in education. They believe in their daughters. My focus right now is continuing my work through Malala Fund and making sure we reach out to as many girls as we can. And there are 130 million girls who cannot go to school right now, to ensure that they can get quality education.
Malala Yousafzai, undeterred, talking there about returning to visit Pakistan this week. She was with the BBC's Sikandar Kermani. We've talked a lot here on the show about the uncertain future facing many Salvadorans living in the United States. Recently, the Trump administration announced it was ending temporary protected status, or TPS, for more than 200,000 Salvadorans here. That means deportations are on the rise, and here's how that works. These people are flown back to El Salvador, and when they get there, they're loaded onto buses and taken to a processing center. My BBC colleague Will Grant recently met some of these deportees as they stepped off those buses and into their new lives.
The stream of people coming off this first bus began with a girl who could barely be 5 years old. There were mothers, grandmothers, there were middle-aged and young men. And that's just the first bus. There's another one behind it. Apparently six arrived yesterday.
The Trump administration says it has sent these deportees home. But for many, home was the United States.
None of those who are walking in front of me, none of the men have shoelaces, or they're wearing slip-on prison shoes. Quite a few are wearing the prison tracksuits that they were given in the United States.
Buenas tardes. Sean bienvenidos y bienvenidos.
They are at least met with a little kindness. A coffee, something to eat, a chance to call family, medical attention. And they are reunited with their possessions, from bootlaces and Bibles to wedding rings and mobile phones. These are the first steps of rebuilding their lives in El Salvador, a country some left a few months ago, but others haven't seen since they were small.
I am on my own in this. I haven't got anyone. These people are my only support.
José is finding it tough to adjust. He has no one in El Salvador, no family to count on.
I had nowhere to go. The situation here is so bad and dangerous. You could easily be killed. So when I arrived at the airport, my only plan was to try to head straight back to the U.S. through Guatemala and Mexico once again.
Instead, he turned to the man he was shackled to on the plane, Miguel Angel. Committed Christians, Miguel and his family opened their modest home to the stranger, offering him a roof over his head and sharing what little they have.
He told me his story, that he was coming back to nothing and had no one to support him back here. So I told him, look, I help you in whatever I can. Don't worry, somehow we'll get by.
The two men have found a little manual work through the church. Earning a day's pay lifts the spirits a little, and they are learning to lean on each other for support. But José's predicament is common. The country he has returned to is hostile and unfamiliar, a place that President Trump recently described in the crudest of terms.
It's real strange for me to come back to my roots, you know, to the place where I was born, because I hardly live here.
Despite their years in the U.S., José and Miguel Angel speak very little English. Others, like William, feel more American than Salvadoran.
You know, I grew up in California, married and got old and, you know, did all my life up there. All of a sudden, I have a problem and I got deported and I find myself in a strange place.
Like other deportees, William is facing many of the same challenges on return: stigma, isolation and unemployment. He will have to find a way out of his situation on his own, he believes, perhaps with the support of an NGO or a little government seed money.
There is some work over here, but it's not pay well, you know. So what I'm thinking right now is trying to take advantage of what I'm good at
and doesn't speak in English. So, you know, I worked as an instructor before. So I'm trying here to open up an academy, an English academy. And then I want to train people, prepare people to work in these call centers. And nobody wants to work for $10 a day, you know. So call centers, they pay between $30 and $35 a day. And that's good for the economy, right?
Politicians in El Salvador know that much needs to be done to create conditions to prevent the exodus in the first place. Some, like U.S.-born Salvadoran Congressman Johnny Wright, are urging the Trump administration to stop framing immigration solely in terms of national security.
You've removed the humane or the humanity component. So we're not necessarily talking about human lives, which are at stake, or the importance of family reunification and all these principles that kind of are the glue that has held the current policy in place.
And beyond changing its thinking, he also wants the White House to change its language about immigrants.
When you have that kind of discourse, you reinforce stereotypes and you reinforce division. In many cases, it's essentially the politics of fear.
Meanwhile, still the waves of deportees return, often having left children, spouses, homes and businesses behind. As we left, we saw Maximo, who hasn't stepped foot in El Salvador in 14 years, reunited with his niece and sister-in-law. They were glad to have him back, but the lumbering, tall man in his 50s couldn't hide the tears in his eyes or disguise the knot in his throat when he spoke. His kids remain in the U.S., and he is lost, a stranger in the country he was born in.
That's the BBC's Will Grant there, reporting from El Salvador. I'm Marco Werman. A top Chinese tech CEO says people in China aren't that worried about the privacy of their data.
If they are able to trade privacy for convenience, for efficiency, in a lot of cases, they're willing to do that.
Many Chinese internet users beg to differ. That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The pressure on Cape Town's water supply is easing a bit. Steep restrictions on how much water people can use have helped push back the day when the city says it might have to shut off its water supplies after years of drought. They call that day zero, a scary prospect that's now been averted, but there's still a water crisis, and people are having to find ways to cope with it. From our Livable Planet desk, Daniela Cheslow tells us about visiting a spring in the city that's become sort of an old-fashioned watering hole.
So you might think the water crisis here is over, but come to Newlands in Cape Town, a beautiful neighborhood with white houses, purple flowers spilling over the hedges in the shadow of Table Mountain, and you'll see a very different picture. I'm standing on a street. You're hearing the clatter of jugs where people are walking empty jugs to the spring. And they're filling up water here to supplement their 50-liter-a-day restrictions.
It's just good water to drink.
That's Sabina Heckscher. When she and her husband Nils started coming to this spring years ago, it was just a secluded little spot at the end of a dead-end street. Today, it's a hub. Dozens of people park nearby and walk down with buckets, bottles, and jerry cans to collect water that flows out of two dozen openings in a white pipe. One of the people here today is Faik Schwartz. He fills his bottles and then washes his face beside the pipe and takes a drink. It's not just that he needs to supplement the water he can draw from his tap. He also doesn't trust his tap water because the reservoirs that supply the city are so low that he believes a lot of sediment is coming through.
One of my flatmates actually had a problem with his stomach due to drinking the water that came out of the tap.
The city says water is safe for drinking, but Schwartz feels better when he fetches water here.
Which is, I think, much safer and pure. There you go.
Schwartz has strapped a black milk crate to his bike, and with some careful tying of twine, he can carry 5 oversized bottles of water, each about a gallon and a half. Cape Town has been warning that the city's taps may run dry because its reservoirs are nearly empty after 3 years of drought. That day would be called Day Zero. To avoid it, the city set tight limits on how much water people can use at home. It also hiked water rates. But if you have time, you can get free relief in dozens of natural springs in Cape Town. They bubble up from a deep underground aquifer, and there are many that haven't been incorporated into the municipal water system. So more people have started coming here in the last few months. Riaz Rawoot watches people take their turns at the pipe from his perch on a stack of concrete blocks. He's a physical therapist who used to come here just for breaks from his office nearby.
I mean, who can't like the city? I mean, it's green, you've got a spring, mountain, blue sky.
A beautiful setting, but it was actually tough to get to the spring itself.
The water used to gush out of a 20-centimeter diameter pipe, and you literally had to go down the stairs, bend over, get your legs wet, and then play with a little pipe in order to fill up your can.
When Rawoot saw that the spring had become a destination, he decided to make it more accessible. He's the one who installed the bigger white plastic pipe and punched it full of holes. The scene at Newlands can be a little jarring. On the one hand, there's a drought, which is why everyone's here. On the other, there's water literally gushing at this site.
You know, it just runs, you know.
Maureen Khran is a retiree. Cape Town's wealthiest residents have spent as much as $15,000 to drill boreholes and tap into the groundwater under their houses. The city's poorest residents live in townships, where they've had to rely on water from common pipes for years. Khran is in between these two extremes, and she thinks about the higher water rates.
I only get a certain amount of money in a month, so I can't pay extra.
Collecting water at the spring has become a little ecosystem. When there are lines, people talk together. Porters cart jugs and buckets uphill to people's cars, and those are often parked bumper to bumper, which can be a pain for some of the neighbors.
We live half a block from the spring.
Up the street, Mark Long locks his front gate. He's the priest at the local church, and sometimes the water collectors fill up the church parking lot or block the streets.
And in fact, I had some parishioners on the corner who sold their house and moved out, because they just couldn't get out at all.
The city has taken some responsibility. On the day I visit, police keep people moving and direct cars as they park. And there can be some positives to having a spring and porters just next door. Long says the porters bring water to the church's school during the week.
Are we getting halfway?
People here say some days things can get testy, with long lines and arguments over people taking more than their share of water. But on this Saturday afternoon, it's downright pastoral, with a sense of easy camaraderie among the people waiting to fill their containers.
Really, I enjoy what I'm doing every day when I come here. Really.
Abbas Mustafa has filled 18 bottles, and he sits for a minute to catch his breath. Do you think a day will come where they have to turn off the taps in Cape Town?
I hope not, but we try to save the water and see how much we can.
Mustafa says he'll save that water until the rains come back. For The World, Daniela Cheslow, Cape Town.
Hey, Daniela.
Hi, Marco.
These were some really great stories over the past few days. But pull back for a moment and share, if you would, some of the big thoughts you had after this assignment. Like, what is the bumper sticker here?
You know, the big thoughts that I had was South Africa is in a drought and it's been going on for 3 years. But what really surprised me was learning that the city sits on top of a vast aquifer system. And if they had just started drilling a few years back, the water crisis that we're hearing about today wouldn't be an issue. But this is something where South Africa has so many other issues, education, health, poverty, that it was not really a priority to start drilling until it was already too late. The other big takeaway I have is how the vast gulf between rich and poor in South Africa is really refracted in the water crisis, with the wealthy paying huge amounts of water to drill into groundwater in their front yards, and the poor saying, you know what, we've actually been in day zero our whole lives. We've always had to rely on standpipe water.
You know, and no matter rich or poor, there is a musical angle to this water conservation business, isn't there?
There certainly is, and I'd like to play you a song. It's called Nana by the South African band Mikasa.
Wake up, Nana. Let's go, Nana. Take a shower, Nana. Nana, Nana.
Wake up, Nana. Take a shower, Nana. That's a...
Yes.
This is a shower song, I guess.
Yeah, this is a song. It's called Nana. It's by the South African band Mikasa, and it's originally 5 minutes long, but we're hearing a sped-up version. It's part of a two-minute shower song album that the city of Cape Town put together with the local bank, Sanlam. But I need you around. Wouldn't be the same without.
2-minute shower songs only on this album. So was this band, Mikasa, were they water conscious before everyone started talking about Day Zero, or did that push them to think more about water?
I didn't have a chance to talk to the band, but I did speak to the producer of the album, and he said that all of the musicians had longer versions of the song, and by shortening them, people would hear the faster songs and get into their head, oh, I should really be zippy in the shower to comply with the water restrictions.
And has it been working?
The shower song is part of a much bigger project by the city to get people aware of water restrictions. So in February, the city said everybody can use 13 gallons of water a day. And if you go over your quota, which you can see in your water bill, there would be steep fines. So it was something where everybody seemed aware of every drop. And I was staying with family in a well-to-do part of Cape Town. Every shower had a bucket in it. You're supposed to collect your shower water, use it to flush the toilet or water the garden. And I would feel really bad if I forgot and flushed the toilet the regular way by accident because I didn't want to drive up my aunt's water bill.
Right. So the Shower Song album is still going to be useful, I suspect.
Absolutely. You know, the city has announced that Day Zero is now not going to happen in 2018, which means there won't be a day where you open your faucet, nothing comes out, and you have to go collect a water ration at a pipe in your neighborhood. But the only way that Day Zero will remain a remote possibility as opposed to happening in the next few months is if people comply with the water restrictions. So these 13 gallons a day, the restrictions will remain in place, right now until the rain comes. So definitely a zippy shower will be helpful in keeping people's water consumption down.
Yeah, I suppose if things get worse, a sequel album would have to have songs with only one verse and no chorus. Let's close with another shower song. It's not a funny thing, but I love this idea. What can you play for us?
I'm going to leave you with Rouge. She's a singer from Pretoria, and she's singing Deja Vu.
Reporter Daniela Chesla, thanks so much for your time, and thanks for the reporting.
Thank you, Marco.
I've been putting in that work, do it day to day, better flow, acting like cartoons, feel like I'm the mate. I could feel y'all beating on my chest, feel like they're the whites. I'ma make a banger with that energy like yesterday. You only feel like deja vu,
Exciting.
It is.
The other day, reporter Jason Margolis came into the studio with a big box. He opened it with my colleague Carol Hills.
Seriously, this could induce rapper rage.
The box was from Candid, the latest company offering orthodontics you do in the privacy of your home.
Well.
Okay, you want to read that?
Congrats. You're about to take the first step toward the new you. To get your treatment started, you'll first need to send us a model of your teeth as well as photos.
Okay, first, you need to clean your hands.
Uh-huh.
You need a towel, mm-hmm. Trays, and you put the putty.
Oh, they're simulating what you do when you go to the orthodontist, which they put all this putty in that thing, and they put it in your mouth, and then you go, bite down on it to create the mold.
That thing is a tray.
And it's very awkward because it's larger than it looks.
So, okay, then there's pictures, walk you through the putty.
Let's go back a page. It says an orthodontist prescribes treatment for you. So how do you communicate with the orthodontist?
Well, let's find out. Let's speak with the man who started the company.
I grew up not having braces. And when I went to the dentist in 2015, my teeth had really started shifting.
That's Nick Greenfield, the CEO of Candid Co. Greenfield looked at his teeth in the mirror as a 20-something and decided it was time to take action.
And I looked at the cost and saw, $5,000 to $8,000 were the quotes that I was getting for doing clear aligners, and started looking into this business and realized that there are, millions, if not tens of millions of people across the country that would absolutely love to do clear aligners but either don't have the time or they don't have the money to actually pay for it.
He says his new service will set you back about $1,900, roughly a third the cost of traditional braces. And to Carol's question, how do you communicate with an orthodontist? They monitor your treatment remotely.
Which means that you don't necessarily have to come into an office every couple of weeks. You're able to send in photos and the orthodontist is able to make recommendations from there.
Greenfield began his career at Lyft. He was the rideshare company's 12th employee. With Lyft, the founders were trying to solve the problem of lack of access to transportation. Now he's looking at ways to address lack of access to orthodontists, not just in rural America, but across the globe.
in the same way that, you know, cell phones in India, for example, help skip some of the landlines or even wired computers. The opportunity for direct-to-consumer clear aligners in markets that are developing where there isn't the same infrastructure for orthodontics and dentistry are incredible. And so we certainly have international aspirations.
This concept, though, braces by mail, has the American Association of Orthodontists concerned.
I think it's important for patients to understand that orthodontics is not a product. Comprehensive orthodontic treatment is a complex medical process.
Kevin Dillard is the group's general counsel. He says it's in the patient's best interest to have treatment under the direct in-person supervision of an orthodontist.
In a modern orthodontic office, there is extraordinary space-age technology that allows the modern orthodontist to be able to diagnose and then come up with a treatment plan that is far more advanced. If patients are being diagnosed based upon nothing more than a simple photograph and a physical model or something like that, that's going back to a time really like in the first half of the last century when that was the only thing that they were being diagnosed with.
He says orthodontists can spot bone anomalies or root problems that a photo could miss. And he warns that if the jaw isn't aligned quite right, braces from home increase the risk of lasting damage. Mark Ackerman is the head of orthodontics at Boston Children's Hospital. He's also executive director of the American Teledentistry Association. He says, yes, orthodontics from home aren't appropriate for everybody.
For a 10-year-old who probably has some type of comprehensive problem, going to a bricks-and-mortar orthodontist is clearly the way to go.
He says for those who want to make some minor improvements to their smile, though, companies that offer clear aligners in a box, and there are several out there right now offering their services mostly to adults, Ackerman says this is the next evolution in care. And let's be clear, he says they're not selling do-it-yourself braces.
Do-it-yourself is really going to a place like Home Depot or Lowe's, picking up some type of wire or rubber band, sticking in your own mouth, trying to move the teeth. In all of these interventions, the doctor is integral to the process.
The leader in clear aligners, Invisalign, now has a stake in at-home orthodontics, and it's expanding its operation into the Middle East and Africa. Those places already have their own orthodontists, of course, but braces remain a luxury item for most. And a surge of new customers could mean big business for these new at-home braces companies. That is, if consumers and orthodontists in Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Kenya are okay with mail-ordered braces in a box. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
Data and online privacy have been on our minds these past few weeks, especially after we learned that the data of millions of Facebook users ended up in the hands of British political analysts at Cambridge Analytica. The Chinese were also talking about similar topics this week, thanks to this.
The Chinese people are more open or less sensitive about the privacy issue.
That's Robin Li, CEO of Baidu, China's biggest search engine, speaking at an event in Beijing earlier this week.
If they are able to trade privacy for convenience, for safety, for efficiency, in a lot of cases, they're willing to do that.
There's a lot of outrage and frustration over what Li said.
Yiting Sun is a journalist based in Beijing.
So I'll just give you a couple of examples of what people are saying on social media here in China. So first of all, they're not really that polite. So one post says, "Who gave you the courage to say something like this on behalf of all Chinese people?" And another post says, "Even if Chinese users can give up privacy for the sake of efficiency, it's not because they want to, it's because they have to."
And do you think the anger you were seeing this week was directed at Baidu specifically or just Chinese tech companies more generally?
I think it's more directed at Baidu. But I think this kind of awareness about data privacy is becoming more salient for Chinese citizens.
So how did the Chinese government come up in any of these conversations or discussions? Was anybody pointing the finger at the central government because the Communist Party is very much in the data collection business, especially as it gears up to launch this social credit system, which is essentially a personal rating system for its citizens?
So I have to say, like in this particular incident, I haven't seen the government coming up at all. But in general, Chinese tech companies and the government are working together So the government will at least in part depend on the data collected by Chinese tech companies to make this kind of social credit rating system come true.
So if there are growing public concerns about privacy in China, what do you think is driving this change? Does it feel new?
Yeah, is you know, what the change has been surfacing since the beginning of this year. So in January, a company called Ant Financial had to apologize to users for automatically enrolling anyone who wanted to see a monthly breakdown of their spending into their social credit rating system.
Wow. So it sounds like the backlash to the whole data privacy thing is fairly new, at least the beginning of this year. Is that fair?
I think it's more like a cumulative effect. Like in the past few years, Chinese consumers' attitude toward all these online apps has been an overwhelming sense of marvel. So look how convenient it is to order takeouts and book plane tickets via smartphones. But I think right now, this wow factor of this kind of convenience is waning. And I think that people are beginning to notice a more sinister pattern.
And what about the Chinese government? Do you think these emerging attitudes about privacy might make the government nervous about its move to create this social credit system, what some are saying is a new form of the surveillance state?
It's, you know, all these things about what the Chinese government is thinking about and planning, all these things are very opaque.
Yeah.
And they are, it's very difficult for anyone to get a real sense of what China's top officials are really thinking about.
Yiting Sun, she's a journalist based in Beijing and a contributor to the MIT Tech Review. Thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Finally today, college basketball fans, who's ready to go to San Antonio? Flaco Jimenez on accordion thinking about San Antonio. It is Final Four weekend. On the men's side, Cinderella surprised. Loyola Chicago takes on Michigan, and the Kansas Jayhawks will play Villanova. My bracket, totally busted, but I'll be watching the action anyway. Is anybody going to San Antonio? Udoka Azubuike is already in San Antonio. He's a big reason Kansas punched a ticket to the Final Four, and I mean big. He's 7 foot, 280 pounds. He's the center and grew up in Nigeria's Delta region. And he's got fans back home happy to go the extra mile to watch him play on Saturday.
Due to the difference in time zone, we always stay up early, you know, to watch some of these games. Those who have cable TV, you know, could watch via that through the ESPN channel.
Femi Adefeso is a sports reporter based in Lagos. He's been watching Udoka Azubuike play for years.
Udoka, he was just known simply for his rim protection and shot blocking, you know, ability, which he was really very good at, although he was about 6'9", 6'10", you know, at that time. But now, he seems to have grown, so I call him the baby Shaquille O'Neal. You know, he is in that paint. He always wants to go up strong, score buckets, really. He has what it takes, you know, to dominate.
And Adefeso won't be the only Nigerian tuning into that Kansas-Villanova game.
Basketball in Nigeria is really huge. Football, or what the Americans call soccer, is actually the biggest sports in Nigeria. But basketball in recent times have grown in leaps and bounds. Apart from the fact that we have a few Nigerian stars in the NBA and the big leagues in Europe, our national teams have been giving us lots of joy. And Nigerians are just passionate about sports. Both the men's and the women's basketball league in Nigeria are well followed. It's really growing locally. There are lots of camps and clinics that go on, you know, year in, year out. So there are lots of kids in academies, always playing, always training. There are a few ballparks, you know, across Lagos where you have all of these local coaches, you know, teaching the fundamentals and the basics, you know, of basketball. So I must tell you, if you think football is number one, basketball is really very close to it.
According to Adefeso, these days lots of young Nigerian kids are watching Azubuike and following in his footsteps.
As a fan of basketball, it's a joy to see a lot of these kids start early, especially the ones who, of course, left from Nigeria to go into the U.S. and how they're able to catch up is phenomenal. You see those guys and you're like very proud, you know, to be a Nigerian basketball fan. You know, it's amazing the number of Nigerian talents, you know, that are in the NCAA, both Division One and Division Two, and how well they are doing. You know, so it gives us pride, you know, as Nigerians, that we have people who are representing us at the world stage, and to know that someone like Udoka is playing in the Final Four. I wish him all the best. I just hope, you know, he stays injury free and hopefully get drafted, you know, by one of the good teams in the NBA in the near future.
And one last cool thing to note, Azubuike's mother Florence won't be watching the game on TV. That's because she managed to get a visa and a flight to San Antonio. This will be the first time she's seen her son play a college game in person. That's The World on this Friday. Our own theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Take us to the weekend, Flaco.
Is anybody going to San Antonio?
PRI, Public Radio International.